You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Good morning. I love hearing all the robust conversations and seeing everybody pop around to the breakout sessions. This is our fourth keynote of the conference, and I'm thrilled to introduce this morning's speaker, Dr. Margaret Levy. Margaret Levy is a professor of political science, a senior fellow for the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, the former Seller Miller McCune director and current faculty fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, senior fellow of the Woods Institute, and co-director of Ethics, Society, and Technology, all at Stanford University. Her research explores how organizations and governments provoke member willingness to act beyond material interest. Levy's most recent books are A Moral Political Economy, Present, Past, and Future, co-authored by Frederica
Carigotti.
All right.
Carigotti.
And published at Cambridge University Press, and In the Interest of Others, co-authored with John Alquist and published with Princeton University Press. Her work has pushed boundaries and provided unique insights into how social life occurs and how institutions shape those interactions. And her key eye also extends to art as a collector of and philanthropist of Australian Aboriginal art. It's my pleasure to get her started. Please take it away.
Thank you, Stephanie. And thank you all for inviting me. I'm going to start with some, as it were, throat clearing. It might be literal. It's been cold in here, so I might clear my throat and sneeze a little. And then I'm going to present some really relatively new material that my co-authors have sort of seen, but almost no one else has. And we could really use some input into that. So hopefully that will provoke some of the question and answers. So this is part of a project which has become a book project that I'm doing with Pablo Barramendi from Duke University, political scientist, comparative political scientist, and Tim Besley, Sir Tim Besley, an economist at the London School of Economics. And we were asked, Tim was asked actually, to participate in the Deaton Review, the Angus Deaton Review on political equality in Britain, several years ago, and the group decided there should be a section on political equality, as well as most of the discussion is of economic equality or inequality, mostly focused on Britain, and Tim asked me if I would co-author with him, which I was delighted to do, and I suggested that Pablo join us because of his one breadth of knowledge about the world, but also his focus on geography as an important variable. And the three of us wrote an essay for the Deaton Review, which is now published. You can get it online. This is the copy. It looks like that on the website, or like that. Sorry, I'm looking down at my screen. Thank you, Michaela, for showing me where I was looking. And that gives you some idea of where we're going with this whole project. But we realized as we wrote it that that there was not enough written or thought about political equality, and that we really had a book project, and that's what we're working on now. And I'm actually going, as Stephanie knows, I'm going from here to London to work with the two of them, so this is very good timing. Now, a large part of what we're going to be dealing with, what we deal with in the book, are issues of conceptualization and measurement. I'm going to argue that political inequality has not been well conceptualized, and it's really barely been measured. A lot more work on economic equality. These are just some statistics and some figures to give you some sense of what's going on. The first one really looks at compares political inequality to economic inequality to see if the two are the same. And they are clearly related, but they're not exactly the same. The next is just to give you some idea of what's been going on, at least in the democratic world, which is what we're studying, so that we see that participation or the suffrage has increased considerably and expanded from what it originally was in democracies, which was largely property of men, starting in the US, but elsewhere as well. And we see that the turnout, so suffrage has increased, turnout increased for a certain period and has been going down, maybe flattening out now. So there's something going on in the electorate that we need to think about, which affects political equality, because if not everybody's turning out, that's one kind of way of thinking about political equality. This is just to give you one group. I will turn to some other groups as we go along. But this has to do with the proportion of women in the electorate, and in particularly in the parliament. And it's connecting to average political participation. We see huge variation among countries, with the US, as it will often appear, sort of at the bottom here of some of the advanced democratic countries in terms of turnout and representation of a variety of forms. This is the proportion of women in parliament over time. You can see it's gone way up. So there's some increasing political equality, at least at one dimension when we think about women. So I will leave you with that, and I'm gonna now turn to the talk. And I'm largely gonna be reading the talk. I apologize for that. I'll give you some stuff where I'm not reading. But I, as I said, it's fairly recently written, so I couldn't quite put it together in a coherent talk. Okay, so issues of conceptualization and measurement is really what I'm going to be focusing on. And I want to argue that there's both a normative and an empirical question here. And our intention in the book is to try to address both. This says answer both, but I think that's a little strong. We're certainly going to be addressing both. Normatively, political equality is an intrinsic good. And the question for us is in part, is it part of what democracy is meant to be built on, but more importantly, to achieve? Is this something we really care about or should care about? I argue that we should. If we can adequately conceptualize political equality, we begin to use it more effectively as a normative standard. So that's part of our goal. But the conceptualization also allows us to measure it. And I'm going to come back to that. But to also to assess trade-offs. For example, Mills is concerned about voters and whether ignorant voters or uneducated voters should be allowed to vote, whether the only people who should be allowed to vote are those who actually become informed about the candidates and the parties. That's a question about political equality. What does political equality really mean there if you're saying that certain people shouldn't be eligible to vote because of lack of knowledge? But these are trade-offs that have to be thought about in a political democracy. We also, once we can conceptualize and measure and think about trade-offs, we can also begin to figure out the multiple equilibria that probably exist. So there's not just one kind of political equality, there may be multiple kinds. Now, there's some additional preliminaries and provisos that I want to mention that will be leitmotifs throughout the talk. The approach to economic equality, is generally distributional. And that's more or less what the Deaton Review focused on, was distributional issues. The approach to political equality also sometimes is distributional or has been distributional. Who has less or more political power, the distribution of influence and power. And distributions of income, wealth, and political influence certainly affect political equality, as we saw in that first figure. But we also think it's very much part of a process, that we don't just want to think about distribution, we also want to think about process. Political inequality in capitalist democracies is a distinctive type of inequality. It's affected by the factors that routinely go into thinking about social, economic, and power inequality, but it cannot be reduced to those factors. I will elaborate all these things. Very important to us, its currency is performative as well as distributive. Politics is inherently an interactive, participatory activity. Thus, even though the study of political inequality does to a significant degree concern the allocation of resources required to exercise power, political equality is also an effect of the nature and quality of social relations. A society, I'm quoting Deborah Satz and Don White here, who in the Deaton Review. Political equality is also an effect of the nature and quality of social relations. A society enjoys equality when its social relations are free of unaccountable power, stigma, or groveling. This requires us to complement the distributional approach in this with an emphasis on political equality as being fundamentally relational and processual. Now, we focus on three key locations for political inequality. And this is part of our conceptual apparatus and part of how we go about studying it. The first is participation, and I showed you some graphs about changes in participation. So is participation relatively equal, and how do we even think about that? The second is representation. Is representation done in a form that allows for relative equal representation of peoples and groups within the society? Does it affect relative equality of influence or not? And how do we even think about that? And the third is responsiveness. So a polity could have relatively equal participation, relatively equal representation, but is it in fact responsive to all the voices and interests that make up the polity? And of course, that immediately raises all kinds of trade-offs because it can't be everything to everybody all the time. So how is that dealt with in a way that serves political equality? Okay, participation. I'm just going to go through these three very quickly, and then I'm going to get into some stuff that I said is really new. Participation, most of the research has been on participation. So there's actually a pretty healthy research tradition looking at relative political equality through the lens of participation. But one of our issues is that this makes the burden of political equality far too much on the shoulders of the citizens, because they're the active participants. In the last breakout session I was in, there was a lot of emphasis on institutional arrangements that could affect that. And I think that, Bobby, you were raising a lot of that. And I think that's an important piece of this story. You can't just put it on the citizens. It's also the arrangements in which citizens are participating. And this raises key questions about democracy. Who is defined as a citizen with full rights of suffrage, assembly, and speech? What is the definition of the demos and its boundaries? Again, a question you were raising and others were raising in the last session. Who has the capacity to mobilize those who share interest? What are the institutional arrangements for and incentives to engage in legal collective action and lobbying? Who should contribute to campaigns, and what principles should govern such contributions? What is the appropriate role of money and financial influence in politics? Now, some of these questions have been studied pretty well, and some hardly at all. So this is, again, laying out a conceptual map of where we need to fill in the pieces. The next group is representation. Who is represented and how? Even when by choice, citizens don't actively engage, don't they still have a right to be represented? And are they, if they haven't actively voted and participated? So that we want to ensure that the proceedings of representation still permit those to be heard who haven't necessarily have a strong way of expressing their voice. And how this can best be achieved is open to considerable debate.
I recommend a recent article by Nicholas Carnes and Noam Lupu in the Annual Review of Political Science in 2023. So we know there's descriptive representation. So we think about representation in terms of are there women in Parliament? Are there blacks in Congress? Are there others who Arab Americans in Congress? That's descriptive representation, counting it that way. We're more interested actually in substantive representation, which often can be linked with some descriptive representation, but is not exactly the same thing. Is a system set up to respond only to active constituents? Are there multiple optima the legislators can have and options? And there's contestation of what constitutes the public good. All of that is part of thinking about what's involved with substantive representation. Okay, an even harder one is political responsiveness. Who benefits from the policies? And we're still debating, Pablo, Tim, and I, about whether this belongs as a third category or something else. Representation and participation, you can really see the way in which voices can be represented. Political responsiveness is really more about the ways in which the government is set up and the institutional arrangements are established. So this raises significant theoretical and empirical challenges. It requires us to include in the analysis unelected government policymakers, bureaucrats, courts, et cetera. Hierarchy and thus inequality is always baked into this relationship. You can't have government at all without some level of hierarchy. And what we want to be sure is that that hierarchy is legitimated and that it's not reproducing the kinds of inequalities that we don't want to reproduce, but is this momentary, as it were, or purposeful inequality for a particular purpose. Nor can responsiveness mean that same thing or same treatment. Daniel Allen discusses parity rather than inequality, for example. Okay. So the bottom line here of this first part of my talk is distribution does matter here. Who has what and how they use it obviously makes a difference. So that will affect political equality and influence. But it is the process that matters as much, perhaps more, since it is the institution's norms and practices that affect how and when citizens act and how and when legislators are responsive. Now I'm going to go into the chapter that we call Political Science and Political Philosophy. And as I said, some of this is new. Some of it is very old, because I'm going to mention people like Hobbes and Locke, who've been around for a while, or they haven't been around for a while, but they part of why they're historical. Okay, so I'm going to read. The study of political equality has its roots in political science analysis of democracy that emphasized equal consideration as an end in itself. This contrasts with the perspective and closely associated with economic approaches that political equality is valuable because of its instrumental benefits. In that view, a system that enfranchises the poor is likely to increase social welfare defined as of utilities and enhance political stability. Broader enfranchisement changes the location of the median voter, and freedom of expression and assembly makes evident and potentially resolvable the sources of expressions of discontent with the status quo. Equitable voice in decision-making has little or no role in this way of thinking. Despite its limitations, the economic approach does recognize some significant effects of suffrage and voice on producing a more equitable political economy and perhaps greater political equality over the long run. For example, and this is the famous North and Weingast article, for example, as the composition of the English Parliament changed in the 17th century, it was able to pass and enforce arrangements that made the Crown's borrowing and other fiscal commitments credible. Consequently, the Crown became more accountable to the legislature. A perhaps greater consequence is the relationship between rule of law and political equality. North, Wallace, and Weingast argue that increased impartiality in the law, in part due to the rise in democratic norms, was an important stimulus to economic growth. Besley and Pearson in 2011 argue something similar. While the impacts may be far-reaching, political equality and even democracy remains the means, not the goals. Many political scientists would agree that there are instrumental returns from political equality, but they are more likely to emphasize the non-instrumental benefits. Fair treatment and empowerment of citizens are constitutive of dignity and freedom, ends in themselves. Robert Dahl proposes two assumptions as a grounding for this position. The first he labels the assumption of intrinsic equality. That is, all human beings are of equal intrinsic worth, that no person is intrinsically superior to another, and that the good or interests of each person must be given equal consideration. The second assumption has to do with who is best qualified to determine the best interests of others when designing the government of a state. And he concludes, among adults, no persons are so definitely better qualified than others to govern that they should be entrusted with complete and final authority over the government of the state. Hence, equal consideration becomes the guiding principle of democracy. For Dahl, this is the notion that in cases of binding collective decision, to be considered as an equal is to have one's interest taken equally into consideration by the process of decision-making. Sidney Verba has similarly advocated for equal consideration, which means that citizen voices are equally expressed and given an equal hearing, even if some receive a more beneficial response. Neither presume that the principle of equal consideration ensures that all get their preferred outcomes or a uniform allotment of government goods, services, and funds, but they differ in terms of what to observe when trying to estimate the extent that equal consideration is operative in practice. Dahl distinguishes goods and interests from preferences, but he struggles to find a satisfactory measure of relatively equal attention to citizens' interests. Verba focuses on voice and on an expression through voting, lobbying, organizing, and other observable forms of expression. A more recent approach from Melissa Schwartzberg and Jack Knight emphasizes the asymmetric bargaining endemic to democracies. For them, the critical concept is equitable treatment of interests as a standard by which to assess when these asymmetries undermine and when they help to secure fundamental interests. These theorists and others struggling with similar issues emphasize process as much or more than outcomes, but understand that the prioritization of who gets what and how has implications for what political equality means in practice. It is insufficient to claim, even if correct empirically, that not all receive equal distribution nor realize their preferred outcomes. The reasons require justification. There need to be standards in place for adjudicating among claims and for determining when some get more, some get less. This is only the beginning of our conceptual problems, however. Equal consideration can apply a variant of equal influence expressed through the vote and other forms of voice, and/or it can apply equal treatment, which itself is a complex term. In terms of influence, equal voice in its simplest form of one person, one vote, does not translate into equal weight in the determination of outcomes. The many reasons for that, we elaborate. In respect to equal treatment, one possible inference is that all get what they need and are owed in terms of government provision of goods and services, even if some get more government goods and services than others. The examples of Hurricane Helene and Milton show that. I mean, right now there are people who really need help, so we wouldn't want to give equal help to everybody else when there are people in such desperate need. Another reading of equal consideration is that the government creates a civil society that engenders and promotes respectful and equitable treatment of citizens by each other. Equal treatment may be intended to enhance material equality, dignity, and a fair distribution, but not necessarily realize strict material equality. As background to the empirical research and findings on political equality, we first explore the perspective of political theorists and philosophers, and then turn to the political scientists, political sociologists, and social psychologists who attempt to transform these theories into empirical research. I'm not going to go through the whole debate, starting with Hobbes and Locke. You can read it when the book comes out, and some of you can already fill it in, I'm sure. Obviously, Rawls becomes a key figure as the debate evolves over time. His idea of a veil of ignorance is recognition of inherent inequalities of resources and skills. But his goal is a system in which all people have moral equivalence and the rights that both protect them and facilitate their capacity to act. He hopes by this means to achieve freedom, equality, and just justice as fairness. I am going to emphasize from Rawls and from Locke, to a large extent, that there is a presumption in liberal theory and ultimately in democratic theory that individuals have moral equivalence. They may not all have equal skills, equal resources, but they are treated as morally equivalent. And that's an important presumption through all of this. I do want to go through a little bit of other theory, and then I'm going to come to how we measure this. Like such predecessors as the French thinker Benjamin Constant and the 20th century British philosopher Isaiah Berlin, Rawls distinguished negative and positive liberties. Negative liberties inhibit interference with person and property by other people and even the government. Positive liberties embrace the rights to participate in politics and to shape a society's collective life. For those political philosophers who make the case for democracy as an intrinsic feature of human agency and as the means to achieve political equality, the positive liberties are as important as the negative liberties. However, they depend on providing citizens with resources needed to exercise the liberties. Here, I'm referring to the pioneering work of Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, who characterize these resources as capabilities. Capabilities are what individuals need and can do to live free and autonomous lives. This means acquiring education, sign petitions, engage in collective actions, enjoy leisure time, develop social networks, etc. Democracy facilitates capabilities specific to empowerment through participation. Both the Rawls and Sen-Nussbaum approaches have greatly informed the philosophical and political theory literatures on relational egalitarianism, which is what I now want to emphasize. A state of affairs in which people treat each other with respect, listen to each other, and tolerate no domination of one another. The important figures here are Elizabeth Anderson, I've already mentioned Deborah Satz and White, and Daniel Allen, who I'm going to rely on a lot. Achieving relational equality requires that all have adequate resources for the development of capabilities, but also necessitates avoiding the dependencies that produce unequal relations and influence. Relational egalitarians, as articulated in Anderson, eschew thinking about inequality in purely distributional terms, whether the currency is material resources, primary goods, or utilities. But that is not to say that distributions, either of material goods or as metaphorical application of non-material goods, such as power, do not matter at all. For relational egalitarians, it is less about focusing solely on some distribution of interest for its own sake than on the distribution of resources that support an environment where people are treated as social equals and can develop social connectedness across various divides. The aim, first and foremost, is to ensure effective and equitable power in the society. However, it is an approach that recognizes how asymmetries in political bargaining and accountable political power, e.g. by elected representatives or appointed bureaucrats, can be consistent with treating all as morally equivalent and having their interests considered legitimate by elected representatives. Okay, so when we think about this issue, I'm going to quote Daniel Allen here, who explicitly applies her model of justice, which can be understood as a variant of the relational equality approach, to representative democracy. The achievement of the overarching goals of justice and human flourishing, she argues, depends on three guiding design principles that ensure democracy is always the pathway to justice. The first is non-sacrificability of both positive and negative liberties for protection of human purpose. She has a very explicit argument against Rawls here, who she sees as only emphasizing one of those, the negative liberties. The second principle is political equality as a first principle of flourishing. And the third is her famous argument about difference without domination. So recognizing the varieties, the heterogeneity of a population without dominating people based on that. Okay, so we go back to how do we even think this through to start to study it? And I go back to that original discussion of power in the United States that was initiated by Dahl, has been picked up by the likes of Adam Jaworski more recently, who defined democracy as a set of institutions and processes of government that permit the expression of the will of the demos, the people. They take equal consideration on board, but part of Dahl's original ambition was to understand power, who has power, right? The famous Who Governs book, and his emphasis on pluralism. So let's think about power and how we conceptualize power. One way of conceptualizing political equality as equal consideration is by thinking about power. Power can refer to the capacity of A to get B to do something she would not prefer to do, ceteris paribus. Power is relational and is also based on access to resources that enable the powerful to define the situation. Powerlessness refers to the lack of resources to resist, either by refusing or bargaining. In the post-World War II era, the famous sociologist C. Wright Mills argued that the United States was governed by a power elite, and there was a whole way of studying the power elite. Polsby, Dahl, others, Banfield, reacted to that to debunk the idea of the power elite. But a significant intervention, particularly for me, came when my professors, before they were my professors, Peter Backratz and Morton Barretts, actually when they were my professors, introduced the idea of the second face of power and non-decision making. And I'm really trying to resuscitate that line of reasoning, which came into a whole set of problems because at the time it proved to be unstudiable. But I think we can study it now. So that's part of what I'm emphasizing. They argued, for those of you who were not around in the 60s or the early 70s or even in the 80s, they argued that the analysis of concrete decisions was inadequate for understanding who was actually in control. This is to quote them. Of course, power is exercised when A participates in the making of a decision. But power is also exercised when A devotes his energies to creating or reinforcing social and political values and institutional practices that limit the scope of the political process to public consideration of only those issues which are comparatively innocuous to A. So it's about agenda setting. It's about ways in which certain voices just are ignored in the process itself. It can be as the third face of power that Stephen Lukes emphasized, coming from Gramsci, it can be, and then as Foucault builds up, it can be a way in which there's hegemony in the way we think, that our minds are affected and we only think of certain things as possible. All of those can contribute to ways in which only certain kinds of ideas, only certain kinds of policies are even considered in the political process. And if that's the case, then there isn't political equality because certain kinds of ideas are excluded and certain kinds of voices are excluded. Okay, so how do we study these things? As I said, what happened to that whole line of argument was it got stuck. Nobody really knew how to study non-decision making. So how do we study these concepts, and how do we measure relational equality to the new concept? Again, it's ever present. It's very strong, perhaps, but how do we get at it? How do we know when there's more of it, when there's less of it, when this one's affected by it, that one's affected by it? So how do we study these concepts? How do we measure them, or at least have a reasonable sense about when there is a lot or none or almost no political equality? Participation and representation are in principle measurable. Although, as we shall see, even this is not as straightforward as it appears at first glance, and a lot of the book is about sorting those things out. What is even more elusive are measurements of relational equality or non-decision making, in large part because what makes them work are largely invisible processes that create shared understandings of appropriate standing and actions within a collective. Measurement issues in this space have plagued social scientists for more than half a century. But by overcoming the disciplinary and methodological specialization that has long plagued efforts such as ours, that must necessarily be cross-disciplinary, it is possible, I think, to make progress. So some of the approaches I'm going to describe begin with individual exchanges, just as economics does. However, they are embedded in social interactions and networks that sometimes disguise the exchanges and sometimes are better understood as relationships of status, deference, and power dependence. So I'm going to use some psychology here, as well as economics, as well as political science, to think about these things. And let me give you three possible approaches to thinking, measuring these concepts. So we've begun to conceptualize them. Now, how do we measure them? Okay, one possibility and a way to get at non-decision making, particularly less relational inequality, is agenda setting. And there's been fabulous work on agenda setting. Charles Plott, Ken Shepsley, lots of people have thought very hard about agenda setting. And we're going to bring that into what we do in thinking about some of these issues. And most of that work, as you, those of you who know this stuff will know, comes much later than when people give up trying to study non-decision making. So there hasn't been a link back to that earlier literature, and that's part of what we will try to do. So my colleague, Tim Besley, is of course one of the great econometricians and survey people, so he tries to get at this with surveys. And he's particularly thinking about relational equality here, so I'm gonna give you some slides that he put together for a talk that try to relate political efficacy and trust, among other things. It's hard to measure relational equality, I've already said that. Some data sets, like the Gallup World Poll, ask questions like, were you treated with respect all day yesterday? So they get at your sense, your perception, your attitude. But this mainly captures daily sentiment, actually yesterday's sentiment in that case, versus a deeper notion connected to status or hierarchy. Responses are almost likely driven by social interactions versus reactions to the state government. One way to capture sentiments of relational equality is to focus on empowerment, a notion put together by Larry Bobo and Frank Gilliam, social scientist and sociologist and political scientist, where they argue the extent to which a group has achieved significant and representation and influence in political decision-making is empowerment. And they have a very interesting way of studying that. Empowerment influences participation because it is a contextual cue of likely policy responsiveness. Empowerment should result in enhanced participation and activation of trust in government. So we should see natural connections between feelings, perceptions of empowerment, and political efficacy and political participation / trust in government and other institutions. And that's what Tim tries to do with these slides. So on one axis is political efficacy, on the other, trust in state institutions. In this one, political efficacy and political participation. And you can see in both of them, that's a very tight relationship, a little less so. Political efficacy and turnout, we see sort of explodes the whole thing. Okay, so what Besley did was, in other parts of his effort to try to get at this at survey, with survey results, and I'm not going to show you the other slides that would take me until 2 or 3 o'clock this afternoon. He honed in on groups that have been historically discriminated against by the state as a treatment group, then focused on broad brush measures of empowerment and feelings of political efficacy alongside their correlates. He used the ANS, the American National Election Studies, to look at Black trust in government relative to others and then its relationship with political activities. And he looked at Jim Crow lynching effects and view, as well as views of police cross-nationally using different kinds of groups as the control groups. And this was to get a better sense of political relational equality. So he needed a treatment group where the treatment is defined based on an experience, positive or negative, with government. So it was a first pass, and the findings are pretty good and pretty interesting and allow us to begin to link what relational equality might do to political participation and action. Okay, what I think is the most promising approach at the moment, particularly given new developments in this approach, is social capital. And here, I'm not just talking about Putnam, but let me give you a little, and I'm gonna really come back to work that Rosh Chetty has been spearheading with his group, particularly with Matt Jackson, who is an incredible network theorist in economics. So social capital had its origins and ideas developed by Glenn Lowry, James Coleman, and Pierre Bourdieu. But perhaps the best known invariant, of course, is Bob Putnam's. As Portes notes, the consensus is growing in the literature that social capital stands for the ability of actors to secure benefits by virtue of membership in social networks or other social structures. Social capital is a product of relationships and social connectedness, which is clearly crucial to relational equality. These relationships can be the strong bonds of family and close friends, but they're also, and I think this is one of the most important pieces of social science of my generation, there is also, as Mark Granovetter compellingly demonstrated, the strength of weak ties. And in fact, a lot of good network theory really depends on weak ties, not strong ties. Being embedded in a network provides access to and references for opportunities, and there are advantages to a widely dispersed, loose set of connections in terms that increase the quality and availability of information. Social capital can be the source of norms that simultaneously constrain and empower behavior. Matthew Jackson labels this variant of social capital as community capital, quote, the ability to sustain cooperative, aggregate social welfare maximizing behavior in transacting the running of institutions, the provision of public goods, the handling of commons and externalities, and or collective action within a community. He notes that this is the hardest form of social capital to study because it is embedded in norms that are features of a society. However, as we'll see as we turn to studies of status and of empowerment, there are ways to investigate both the causes and effects of norms and community capital. So how do we study social capital for this purpose? Putnam uses surveys. An alternative approach, as I said, is network analysis. By analyzing the structure of networks, it is possible to observe, predict, and even measure who will have greater access to information, opportunities, control, and what Burt labels structural autonomy. Network analysis also provides insight into power, as the work of Blau, Cook, Emerson, et cetera, have shown us. especially when defined in terms of dependency relationships. Recent work in economics on networks opens new pathways. Here we want to focus on the research coming out of Raj Chetty's lab on the social capital produced through neighborhood interactions. They measure social capital as one, cross-type connectedness, which is the extent to which different types of people, for example, high income versus low income, are friends with each other. Two, network cohesiveness, which is the degree to which friendship networks are clustered into cliques and whether friendships tend to be supported by mutual friends. And three, civic engagement, which we measure using indices of trust or participation in civic organizations. Using data the team acquired from Facebook, the authors demonstrate first that economic connectedness across socioeconomic status is an important predictor of income. Those whose parents have low SES but come from neighborhoods that facilitate cross-class interactions are likely to attain higher incomes than those with similar backgrounds in neighborhoods with a relative paucity of economic connectedness. The other measures of social capital have far less, if any, effect on future income. The team considers the means for increasing connectedness. The first is through programs such as busing and integration that increase exposure across classes. The second is by reducing friending bias, that is the tendency for people with low SES to be the echo chamber, is basically what it's trying to reduce. They conclude that both mechanisms are essential and both are shaped by social structures and institutions and therefore can be influenced by policy changes. The work on social capital as social networks provides insights into both relational equality and non-decision making. Those who lack social capital will have fewer opportunities and a lower probability of acquiring relational equality, at least in terms of economic and political connections. Their position in the network also reduces their options for political influence and access. Moreover, it heightens their power dependence, which is a further detriment to speaking up, trying to set the agenda, or even becoming involved. The next thing I want to look at is deference and status as a way to get at these questions. Since at least Max Weber, status has shared a rhetorical position with wealth and power as one of the three principal sources of inequality. The emphasis has largely, however, been on socioeconomic status. Now discussions of relational equality and related concepts emphasize the importance of social standing, dignity, and respect, often synonyms for social status, as essential to achieving political equality and private governance, as Elizabeth Anderson demonstrates, civil society, look at Danielle Allen, and hierarchy more generally. Anderson has some work forthcoming on this issue. It is through status and deference, arguably, that the second face of power works, second face of power being non-decision-making. Individuals who lack significant political power and possess low status find themselves in a position where their best choice, psychologically and politically, is to recognize the authority of others, whether they agree with the given status hierarchy or not. The fact is that they have little means to challenge that hierarchy. The second face of power undermines both relational and political equality. The observable and measurable mechanisms of this process have largely been elusive, however. This is one of the reasons why the empirical research on the second face of power dead-ended. But as I've said, there have been significant methodological advances since that time. There are now ways to measure deference and status that make the concept useful for analyzing political power and equality. The investigation of status has a long and distinguished history, particularly in social psychology, but its findings have yet to be adequately incorporated into political science, with a few notable exceptions, let alone into political economy more generally. Cecilia Ridgway and Sylvia Nakagawa define low status deference as acceding to the judgments of higher status members in regard to group decisions, even when those judgments disagree with the low status member's own, an action that grants higher status members influence and standing in the group. They measure deference by assessing through experimental and survey methods the expectations group members have of each other in regard to two distinct characteristics, status and competence. This includes a self-assessment of one's own standing. This method of assessing low status deference has been validated through multiple studies over time. The important takeaway here is that status is a group property conferred and reinforced by the group. Moreover, the individuals usually agree with the group's assessment of their position in that particular setting. A key to the perception that a status hierarchy is legitimate is the perception that those higher in status are competent. This characteristic is also one reason why status hierarchies can be staple for centuries. Witness feudal Europe or Hindu India. Nevertheless, they possess within them the seeds for their disruption, as social psychologist Susan Fiske has made clear. Given that those higher in the hierarchy scorn those below and those below envy those above them, she argues that being bested makes a person feel helpless and hopeless. Rather than take it out on ourselves, we find it far more soothing to blame someone else. Inferiority-based anger focuses on the fortunate precisely because facing our own shame is so intolerable, and rightly so. For nothing is scarier than wounded pride. Violence commonly erupts from threatened egoism, especially from an insecure egoist. I feel like I'm talking about American politics right now. Directing anger outward lets us avoid focusing on our own humiliation. Comparisons thus lay the ground for violence because coming up short can make the fault someone else, or so it seems. To bring the issue back to political inequality, we need to consider how status hierarchies are related to power hierarchies. First, it is important to note their distinctiveness. Here I'm going to quote Rob Willer. Where power refers to an individual's relative control over resources, the status of an individual is her relative standing in a group in terms of respect, honor, and prestige. Power and status hierarchies have quite different properties. Second, status and esteem that are derived from competence and wealth may enhance both power and the perceptions of its legitimacy. However, experimental evidence suggests that this pathway can be undermined if the powerful are perceived as greedy and selfish. Other experiments reveal that philanthropy and moderation of power are mechanisms to reestablish esteem for the powerful. This confirms the findings from other experimental research that there are reputational gains to costly signals of actions that enhance group welfare, whether they be in the form of charity on the part of the powerful or social mobilization of those seeking power. If individuals or groups believe the setting and structures that confer their given status are wrong, inappropriate, or unfair, the implication is that the path to change is collective action and structural change. However, they must first weigh the benefits they receive from deference with the cost of possible punitive actions should they deviate from the current normative framework. They must also consider the costs of mobilizing should they choose that option. These insights and findings from social psychology have their counterparts in work by sociologists and political scientists investigating power inequality. The literature on empowerment, which I've already noted, is one example. The result is enhanced participation and activization of trust in government if you follow the method that Bobo and Gilliam follow. Using the general social survey, the first is measured by socio-political participation, and the second through GSS surveys on trust, efficacy, and political knowledge. Related work on India reveals that the holding of political office by a low-status group, the scheduled castes, can heighten respect for them even when it does not alter resource distribution or the underlying power balance. From our perspective, however, there is an increase in relational inequality. Another approach exemplified and summarized by Tali Mendelberg derives from the symbolic politics literature, an older literature by Edelman and Gusfield, in which politics and governments confer status and social rank through symbolic signals of norms of social value. Mendelberg posits that social status is often a better explanation of political action than instrumental motivation. She follows others in arguing that comparisons of rank or status can be a source of conflict and of mobilization. This is particularly true of those who have high status in a low status group and believe they deserve a higher status. It is also true of those who feel they are losing status to those relative they have long thought of as inferior. Status reversal is a proven precipitant to action, often in the form of backlash and even violence. One signal of status reversal is numeric. For example, a series of studies by Maureen Craig and Jennifer Richeson reveal that white majorities become more conservative when the growing number of minorities is made politically salient. On the other hand, receiving validation for being obedient, compliant, and respectful of those above you, qualities that indicate subservience, can contribute to the maintenance of inequality when individuals gain a sense of dignity and self-esteem from such reinforcement, often unfelicitously called the Uncle Tom phenomenon. Thus, assessments of status can cut both ways. They can be precipitators to action and demands, and they can facilitate passivity. There's considerable theory about the context in which status is likely to produce one kind of outcome or another. Now, surveys, experiments, and well-designed observational studies offer means to assess how individuals perceive their status. Moreover, one can link those assessments to views about fairness of the system, anger with or acceptance of the status hierarchy, the trustworthiness of government, etc. So what I hope I've done here, and I'm now concluding, is that there are now possible ways to study critical aspects of political equality and inequality that derive from the second face of power, from non-decision making, and that derive from new understandings that we've begun to develop of relational equality. I think we're right at the beginning of that path, and I really want to encourage, we're going to try to do some in this book and sort of lay out some of the groundwork for that, but I hope that others follow through, show us wrong, move us in different ways, but build on these literatures and see that there's hope in actually studying this important part of, I think, political economy. So to conclude, what we hope to show in the book is that political equality is a worthy ideal and intrinsic good important for democracy. It supports democracy, but is also created by democratic rules. We can now measure aspects of it and assess how well we are doing, and measure aspects of it beyond political participation, which obviously can always be improved in our measurement and understanding, but which an incredible amount has been done, but not so much on the others. But there are trade-offs always. More political equality means more voices, which means plurality and wisdom of the crowds, but also more contestation, even polarization, as we're seeing, and an intensification of uneven preparation for the vote. We cannot ever assure that all will use their voice equally, even where vote is compulsory, but we can try to ensure that everyone has the right capability and possibility to do so. Whatever we find, the effect will, we hope, make government processes more participatory, representative, and responsive. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.